Okay, all right. So you may remember last week we did an intro overview of the Judges as a whole. Spent our whole time last week with kind of a lot of background information, which I hope was not quite a fire hose of information. On that, you may remember our Old Testament timeline, where we've got Judges is JD right here. And if you look at your packet, you've got a copy of this timeline. Judges is situated in the time at the end of Joshua's life, as the people were coming into the land after the wilderness wanderings, and before the beginning of the era of the monarchy for Israel, the united monarchy under Saul. And so the period of the Judges runs from the end of Joshua's life, really, to the start of Saul's kingship. And some scholars have argued that Samuel is actually a judge, though we call him a prophet, but he would fit into that era of the Judges, that era of Israel's life when they did not have a centralized government, okay, under a monarchy. And so we remember that timeline. You may also remember our map of all loosely connected tribal league of Israel. What we're going to find in as we move through Judges is that Judges, as we're going to see it tonight in chapter 1, starts with Judah. And as we move through Judges, it's going to move northward in the stories that it tells. Okay? And so we've got this southern to northern movement in the way that Judges was edited together. And so just kind of keep that in the back of your mind as we start with Judah at the beginning of Judges. So a little bit of a review from last week, because I want us to hold this in our heads as we get started. And here's a packet for you if you didn't get one. Yep, you're welcome. So we remember, again, Joshua concludes and the promised land was not fully conquered. So Joshua concluded with a kind of a triumphalist ending. Double the doves tonight. Would you like to have a
pack? I was hoping to sort of sneak in without being called out.
Oh, man. It did. Come on in. We're just going over some background information from last week. And we remember that the book of Joshua ends with this triumphalist note, implying that they moved into the land, they conquered everybody, there's no Canaanites, and everybody lives happily ever after. Okay, but then Judges begins and is pretty plain in the idea, in the fact that's not really the case, that didn't happen that way. We also remember that Judges happened somewhere between 1250 and 1050. We've got a period of about 450 years of Israel's life here that we're looking at. And this is a composite piece of literature, meaning the stories in Judges were passed down orally over a long period of time. And it is likely that during the Davidic monarchy, these stories that were passed down orally were written down and compiled or edited together. Okay? And so we can see how many of these stories were passed down orally, and they have to do with the northern tribes. But we're going to start Judges with which southern tribe? Judah. Why do you think in the Davidic monarchy they would begin Judges with a story of Judah? Does that make sense? You see where this is coming from? Yeah, right. So you can see the influence of the Davidic monarchy in the editing of Judges together. Also, Judges is going to conclude that that apart from clear leadership, things kind of devolve into chaos. So it is at once an affirmation of the monarchy, but it's also Judges as a whole functions as kind of holding up a mirror to Israel as a nation and the monarchy in particular to say, listen, if you don't get your life with God right, things can fall off really fast. Okay? Your unfaithfulness failure to worship God alone can lead to some dire consequences. Okay, so one more thing about the major characters of Judges. We know this word judges means to save or deliver. So the judges were not lawyers. They were not a judge in a law court, as we might think of this word. They were charismatic military leaders whom God raised up for specific times and for specific tasks. And the judges are not themselves examples of holiness. Okay? Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. Amen. All right, so the judges are not religious reformers. If you remember from last week, we kind of go in this movement at the beginning of the book of Judges. We have a couple of judges that are pretty okay. And then we get to some judges that are, frankly, bad. And then we get to some judges that are terrible. And then at the end, all hell breaks loose, all right, throughout all the nation. So you can see this movement toward chaos. You can see the direct line between a failure to be faithful to worshiping God alone and the Israelites devoting themselves to God, both their leaders and the citizens, from that to the utter chaos at the end of the book. Okay? We see the major and the minor judges. We're going to get to all of them this semester. And then, of course, we know that the Canaanites are another term we're going to see over and over again. Canaanites is the general term for all the different people groups who lived here when the Israelites come to town. Okay? And we're going to see a whole bunch of names of them tonight. And Judges ends with general chaos and anarchy. And Judges gives no clear teaching on piety, ethics, or worship. However, we will try to ask good questions about how do the stories we read each week function to orient our understanding around the primary themes of Judges toward faithfulness to God and worship of God alone. Okay? All right, so let's jump into chapter 1. We're going to look at chapter 1 and 2 tonight. Here's what I'd like us to do. I want us to read chapter 1 together using the Voice translation. Anybody used the Voice before? Okay, so the Voice is a really handy-dandy translation, and it kind of divides the text into different readers. So I need several people who like to read out loud. We got one. All right, okay, so I need somebody who will be the Israelites. Tony will be the Israelites. Who wants to be the Eternal One? That's God. All right, here we go. Eternal One. Yes. Who wants to be the tribe of Judah? All right. Come on. Who wants to be Adonai Bezek? You get your thumbs cut off. Who wants to be Adonai Bezek? Daniel. All right. Okay, that's okay. Who wants to be Caleb? Yeah, come on, the Caleb. He was one of the 12 spies. He's one of the only spies who said, we can take it. All right, here we go. Who wants to be Aksah? That's Caleb's daughter. Who wants to be Caleb's daughter? Aksah. All right, Janice, here we go. Okay, let me see. Who else do we need? I think that's it. Okay, I will then be... I'll be the narrator. So if all the spots that are not a person's name, I will be the narrator. Okay? So, all right. So everybody ready? You see where you're reading? This is chapter 1. We're going to read it together, and then we're going to look at what it says. Then we're going to read chapter 2 together, look at what it says, and then we have some questions to wrestle with tonight. All right, here we go. I'll begin. After Joshua died, the people of Israel asked a question of the Eternal One.
Judah will go and fight. See, I have given the land into their hands. The tribe of
Judah enlisted support from the tribe of Simeon.
If you will help us fight for the land we were given in Canaan, we will do the same for you.
The tribe of Simeon agreed to help them. So Judah and her ally went up to fight against Adonai Bezek at the town of Bezek. And the Eternal gave them victory over the Canaanites and the Perizzites. They killed 10,000 of them at Bezek. And although Adonai Bezek tried to escape, they caught him and cut off his thumbs and big toes, which rendered him useless for basically anything.
In my time, I cut the thumbs and toes off 70 kings and left them to scramble for scraps under my table. And now God has done the same to me.
They carried him away to Jerusalem, where he died. Then the people of Judah attacked Jerusalem, and when they had captured it, they killed many, burned the city, and destroyed it. After that, the people of Judah swept down upon the Canaanites, remaining in the highlands and in the lowlands and in the southern desert. Judah campaigned against the Canaanites of Hebron, formerly Kiriath Arba, where they defeated Sheshai, Ahiman, and Talmai. And then they went out in battle against the people of Debir, formerly Kiriath Sefer. It was about this battle that Caleb had made a vow.
Whoever attacks and captures Kiriath Sefer will receive my daughter Aksa as his wife.
Othniel, the son of Caleb's younger brother Kenaz, captured the city. So Caleb gave Othniel his daughter Aksa to marry. And when she came to Othniel, she persuaded him to ask her father for a field. And she dismounted from her donkey. Caleb approached her.
What do you wish?
Here is what I would like as a wedding gift. Since you have given me a place in the southern desert, also give me some springs of water.
And so Caleb gave her the upper and lower springs. The people who descended from Moses' father-in-law, Hobab the Kenite, went with the people of Judah from the city of palm trees into the wilderness of Judah, and they settled there with the people, the Amalekites, in the southern desert near Arad. Then Judah and Simeon defeated the Canaanites who lived in Zephath and destroyed them completely. So their city was renamed Hormah, which means destruction. Judah went on to take the cities of Gaza, Ascalon, and Ekron, and all the land surrounding them. The Eternal was with Judah, and the tribe conquered all the highlands. But those living in the plains had iron chariots, so Judah could not drive them out. Caleb received the land of Hebron, as Moses had promised many years earlier, and he drove out the three sons of Anak. The people of the tribe of Benjamin, however, did not drive the Jebusites out of Jerusalem, and the Jebusites lived alongside the Benjamites in Jerusalem to this very day. The tribe of Joseph went up against Bethel, which was formerly known as Luz, and the Eternal supported them. They sent out spies who intercepted a man leaving the city. All right, who will read spies? Will you read the spies? He showed them the way, and they destroyed the city with swords. But as they had promised, they let the man and his family go. This man went into the land of the Hittites, and there he established a city. He called it Luz, and that is still its name. The tribe of Manasseh failed to drive out the people who lived in the cities and surrounding villages of Beth Shean, Tanakh, Dor, Ibleam, and Megiddo. The Canaanites continued to live in those regions, for they were determined to live there. But when the people of Israel grew strong, they made the Canaanites their slaves and did not completely drive them out. So it was with the tribe of Ephraim, who did not drive out the Canaanites who lived in Gezer, but lived among them. Zebulun also did not drive out the people of Kitron or Nahalol, so these Canaanites lived among them and became their slaves. Asher failed to drive out the people of Akko, Sidon, Alab, Achzib, Helba, Afik, and Rehob. Instead, the tribe of Asher lived among the Canaanites who lived in the land. Naphtali did not drive out the inhabitants of Beth Shemesh or Beth Anath, but lived among these Canaanites who lived in the land. They also became slaves of Naphtali. The Amorites pushed the tribe of Dan back into the hills and did not allow them to dwell in the valley. The Amorites persisted in living out on Mount Heres and Ajalon and in Shalbim, but the tribe of Joseph overpowered them and forced them into labor. In those days, the border of the Amorites ran from the heights of Akrabim to Selah and beyond. Whew! All right. Did you notice in that chapter a mixture of fighting and conquering and kicking out and a mixture of not doing any of the above and settling together, living alongside one another, and a mixture of enslaving other peoples among them? Yeah. So interesting, as we look at chapter 1, so chapters 1 and 2 of Judges form the introduction. Okay, this is going to set the stage for all the stories that we're going to see throughout the book of Judges. And in chapters 1 and 2, we're going to find the interplay between Israel's experience in the land overlaid with, in chapter 2, a theological lens of God's character, identity, and purposes laid over the top of their experience in the land as they come into the land and interact with the Canaanites. Okay, so chapter 1 is going to show us an intro from Israel's lived perspective, their lived experience, which we find is not triumphalistic. It's more of a muddled, you know, mixture of conquering some people, living alongside some people, enslaving some people, mixing with some people. It's kind of all of the above, right? And so already in Judges, at the very beginning, it's going to contradict the end of Joshua. It's going to say, this is what it was more likely like. And we also know, again, we said this last week, that we know from archaeological studies that there is zero evidence that Israel drove all the Canaanites out of this region or conquered them. The archaeological evidence matches, at least in a parallel way, what Judges tells us, which was a mixture of groups conquering each other, with a mixture of settling alongside one another, with a mixture of intermarrying with one another. Okay, so it's kind of all of the above. And over time, the dominant culture that wins out is the Israelites. Okay. But that is going to be a rocky road for the people of Israel as they are moving into the land. And a rocky road not only in terms of their spreading into the land, but in terms of their faithfulness or infidelity to Yahweh. Okay? So the rockiness of that spreading into the land is matched by the rockiness of their struggle with faithfulness in this transitional period between the wilderness wanderings and the monarchy. So chapter 1 shows us kind of the human motivation side, the reporting of events, the reporting of some military successes, but some military failures, frankly. In fact, the book begins with fighting. Here it begins with Judah fighting the Canaanites. And when we get to the end of Judges, Israel's going to be fighting. But who will they be fighting?
Each other.
So already here we have this what will be the start of a spiraling progression into violence turned on one another. Yes?
Do you think the writers at this time, or the people this time, did they have trouble like justifying sort of like a lack of divine interference? I mean, you know, like when God took them out of Egypt, right, like that was divine. And here, it's very human. It's like God's just watching and not really involved.
Yeah, so chapter 2, when we get there, like that's the authors of Judges are trying to answer that question.
Okay.
Like they're going to struggle with, that's the question of theodicy is, where is God, where is Yahweh showing up? Why is he not showing up for us now? What is there a reason? And so then their explanation is going to be this literary cycle, which is a theological paradigm for how they interpret their experience, which is going to be from, well, we're going to see it in chapter 2. We've got it written out. So, yes?
By the time, and this may not make any difference, but by the time Judges is written, by the time we have Judges, chapter 1 or 2, pick one, how many generations are they removed from the generation that came through the Red Sea?
Well, in chapter 2, it's going to tell us that the whole generation that experienced the wanderings with Joshua. So Joshua's generation.
So the end of Exodus is what it's going to be, from the end of Exodus to Judges. How many?
I don't know how many generations that was. I know that we had to have a whole new generation raised up in the wilderness to get into the Promised Land.
That's why I was asking.
So we have a generation that lived through the Exodus. Mm-hmm. They die in the wilderness because they were unfaithful. Then we have a new generation raised up.
Right.
They come into the Promised Land with Joshua.
Right.
Joshua dies. We're going to see that. Well, we see that at the beginning of 1, but again, a further explanation at the beginning of chapter 2. Joshua dies. And then the whole generation that experienced that,
right,
the end of the wilderness wandering.
Right.
And with a connection to their immediate connection to the generation before them that experienced the Exodus, they will pass away. And a new generation is going to arise in here for the judges. Stories
so
that doesn't remember.
Third generation, basically.
Yeah, at least.
At least
yeah.
three. At least.
At
three.
Least.
It's just
yeah.
interesting to me when you think of 45 to 50 years being sort of a generation-ish. That's not very long.
It's not. And in fact, what we're going to find in chapter 2 is one of the first things the people of Israel are indicted on, which is in chapter 2, this theological framework for the rest of the letter. We're going to then see played out over and over again. It's their failure to remember.
Yes.
Remember who God is and what God has done.
But isn't it the previous generation's failure to teach?
Yeah, come on. That's it. Like, so whose responsibility is it to learn and to teach? Right? So we're going to... So now we're getting to questions of how do we apply this to us today? And so we're going to come to that question. Yeah. Come on. You're going to get to say it. I promise. Like, so y'all are just on the ball tonight. So you're getting to where we're going to land the plane in just a few minutes. So where were we? All right. So chapter 1 begins with the death of Joshua. Judah, we start with Judah. And of course, as we go through the book, we move northward. And then we also find... this interesting little story about Caleb, Oxen, Othniel. So we get this little glimpse in this story. It's like we start off with this 30,000 foot view of Judah fighting these different Canaanite groups. And then we hone in on Caleb, his daughter, and Othniel and look closely at one of these interactions. And then we're going to back up again and look at these various tribes who failed to drive out the Canaanites. And as we move from 30,000 foot view to this close-up little story and then back out, we see a couple of things here in chapter 1 in the Israelites' experience and perspective. We find that some Canaanites were defeated. Okay, so that did happen. We find some Canaanites were subjected to forced labor. And my commentary on that is... Israel is now taking on the characteristics of Egypt. Okay, so you failed to remember. Okay, so it's subtle here in chapter 1, but we're going to get there.
Or maybe you did remember and you thought it was good for you to be in charge.
Yeah. There's this danger in self-assertion, right? The danger is the assumption that I can be God of my own life and that I can use that godhood over against others for my own gain. That's part of the human condition in sin. And I think that's, we're going to see that in Judges. We're going to see it over and over again for individuals, in individual stories with the Judges. And we're going to see it on a macro systemic level for the people of God, right? So what's true of individuals can be true of whole communities in their struggle with sin. And when it becomes true of whole communities, that's when you see systemic oppression occur. And whole communities taking on characteristics of sinfulness, those models of behavior they saw from other countries like Egypt that did not know Yahweh. Yeah.
In my mind that when the voice of God died, which was Joshua, it seemed like the Israelites took on their own identity when mm-hmm. they believed. You know what I mean? They stopped listening. When that voice stopped, they stopped.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. So this is key here, right? Because when they had Moses, who would get direct revelations and then speak them to the people, and Aaron. Aaron was the mouthpiece, but in Moses. And then Joshua. But in the lack of this leader with a direct connection to God's guidance, we enter into this season of chaos where the people failed to remember collectively, and there was no centralized leadership for the people in terms of their relation to God and in the way that they governed themselves, right? And so what we find is we can see these realities, the realities of this struggle, in all the different ways they relate to the Canaanites, being like Egypt and forcing some of them into slavery, settling alongside some of them. And we're going to see, why does that matter? Well, because in chapter 2, we're going to find as Israel settles alongside some of the Canaanites and intermingles with them, Israel begins to take on some of the Canaanite religious characteristics. So there is a religious syncretism that begins to happen over the course of time. So that's chapter 1, Israel's perspective. How are we doing? 7 o'clock. We got 15 minutes. Let's look at chapter 2. I need just a couple of people to help with chapter 2. Who wants to be the messenger? I see that hand. All right. I need one more, I think. Who wants to be the eternal one? Come on, you're the eternal one tonight. All right. All right, and I'll be the narration. All right, so this is chapter 2. Chapter 1, remember, Israel's perspective and their general failure to drive out the Canaanites. And now we're going to get laid on top of their experience and perspective, a theological lens for this history. Okay? Thinking about who is God, what is God's relationship with Israel, and why does that matter for the Israelites' experience in history. All right, here we go. The Eternal's messenger traveled from Gilgal to Bochim.
I rescued you out of the land of Egypt and brought you into this land that I had promised to your ancestors. I said, I will never break my covenant with you. As you're part of this bargain, you shall not make a covenant with the inhabitants of this land. You must tear down the altars of their gods. But you did not do as I commanded. Do you realize what you have done? Now I tell you, I will not drive them out before you. The people of the land will irritate you, and their gods will ensnare you.
When the Eternal's messenger spoke these words to Israel, the people wept bitterly. So they named that place Bochim, which means weeping. And there they sacrificed to him. When Joshua sent the people away, each tribe of Israel went to gain possession of its territorial inheritance. The people served the Eternal as long as Joshua lived, and through all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, those who had seen all the great works of the Eternal that the Eternal had done to Israel. Here was our previous conversation. Joshua, son of Nun, the Eternal servant, died at the age of 110 years and was buried within the borders of his inheritance at Timnath-Heres in the hills of Ephraim, north of Mount Gash. Now that whole generation, the generation that had walked with Moses, the generation that saw the walls of Jericho fall, that generation passed on, and another generation grew up after them, a generation that did not know the Eternal and had not seen the great works he had done for Israel. Consequently, this new generation served the gods of Canaan, the Baals, as they were called, doing what the Eternal God considered evil. They abandoned the Eternal One, the true God of their ancestors, who brought them safely out of Egypt. Instead, they began to serve the gods of their neighbors, the Canaanites, bowing low before their images, causing the Eternal to burn with anger. The Israelites abandoned the worship of the Eternal One and turned to serve Baal and his consort, the moon goddess, Ashtoreth. Ashtoreth is the feminine counterpart to the male Baal. So the Eternal's anger burned hot against them, and he caused them to be overcome by those around them, using their enemies to plunder them so that the Israelites could no longer stand against their enemies. And whenever they marched into battle, the hand of the Eternal One was raised against them in evil, as he had warned and promised them, and they were in anguish. But the Eternal appointed judges among them, leaders and liberators, who rescued the Israelites from the enemies who plundered them. Even then, the people of Israel did not listen to their judges, but instead passionately pursued other gods and bowed down to them. How quickly they turned from the faithfulness exhibited by their ancestors in obeying the Eternal's commandments. This younger generation did not follow their ancestors' example. Still, Whenever the Eternal appointed judges among the Israelites, he was with each one, saving the Israelites from their enemies as long as that leader lived, for he was moved to compassion by the groans of his people when they were persecuted and oppressed. But when the judge died, then the people would fall away from their faithfulness, and the next generation behaved even worse than their ancestors, pursuing and serving other gods and bowing down before them. They would not change their bad habits, but clung to them stubbornly. So the Eternal's anger burned hot against the people of Israel.
Since these people have violated the covenant I gave as a commandment to their ancestors and no longer listen to my voice, I will no longer drive out from their path any of the nations who still remain in this land when Joshua died. I will put my people to the test to see whether or not they will walk the faithful way of the Eternal as their ancestors did.
So God did as he promised. He left those pagan nations in the land of Canaan. He did not drive them away immediately, nor did he give them into the hands of Joshua and his armies. Okay. All right. Let's talk about chapter 2. Okay, so chapter 2, I think, gives us a theological lens for God's purposes and actions in history from Israel's perspective. And this is not history so much as a theological framing of the narrative that is the remainder of Judges. What do I mean by that? So when we say history, I think today what we mean by that word history is we have people who recorded in real time as the events were happening and kept a record of it that is verifiable to others as we examine that evidence. Okay? When we say history, all right? Now, history usually has perspective. Well, it always does, but still. We think of history as like major world events, right? And as they happen, we have people that record those things, and then we get record of them, okay? In Judges, this is theological history, right? These were oral tradition stories passed down over generations and now being edited together, right? And so for Israel, history is theological in the sense that the events that happened in their life, in their existence as a people, for good and for bad, their faithfulness, their infidelity, their interaction with the world around them, from the Exodus to settlement in the Promised Land, that whole history is framed by their interaction with Yahweh. Okay? And so for them, history has a creator and it has a design. And so when we read chapter 2, we see this theological lens laid over their experience in the world. And I think that's important. Okay? And here, we see a couple of things happen in chapter 2. It begins with the angel of the Lord reminding Israel of what defining story that happened in their history. What was it?
Brought
you out of Egypt, right? There's two things. God brought you out of Egypt, that's the Exodus, and God made what with you? A covenant. Right. So, right away, we have this theological history. I say it's theological history because the Pharaohs probably wouldn't define the Exodus in the same way the Israelites did. Right? Probably not. Okay? And so, the Exodus is the defining salvation narrative of the Old Testament. It tells the people, number one, who God is. What does the Exodus say about God's character? God keeps his promises. He's able to do that. And he's a rescuer. Okay? God is a rescuer. He keeps his promises. And God is able to rescue the people of Israel, even when the powers of the world are insurmountable, right? Because the Israelites lived in a world that was not monotheistic, right? I mean, they served Yahweh alone, but they lived in a world where the other nations served a pantheon of gods. And when one nation conquered another nation, they assumed it was because their gods were stronger. But the Israelites, as they began to see their God could redeem them out of Egypt and all their pantheon of gods. This is very important. that they understand who God is and what God is capable of. And so we have this reminder at the very beginning of chapter 2 of who God is and of their history. And that's important because what happens just a couple generations removed from those who experienced those stories? What does chapter 2 tell us? These new generations in Israel did what? They forgot.
But
yes.
You know, this theological history,
yeah,
as you put it together, is very important for all of us.
Yes.
I think that we as postmodern people, we think that these miraculous events were unique and only applicable to the past history, while if we pay attention,
yes,
we can see the overwhelming faithfulness of God despite horrible rejections and unfaithfulness,
yes,
from all of us. And these events can be interpreted from different point of views, but when we are the in crowd, then we must remember that they are applicable today.
Yes.
In the events that,
yes,
affect us.
We read the story and we are reminded, we are called to remember. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really interesting, to your point, Luis, multiple times in the second section of chapter 2, right after it tells us that Josh introduces this. Well, let's just go to that. Chapter 2, verse 6, we find kind of verbatim a reference, this is a reference from Joshua. But here we see that the people, in verse 7, served Yahweh. They served the Lord. And Lord is all, if Lord is all capital letters in your English translation, that's God's personal name. That's Yahweh. Okay? So they served Yahweh. This is the same word that's translated worshiped or served later in this chapter when it says that the Israelites worshiped or served the Baals and the Ashtoreths. Okay? So what I would say in response to Luis, to your point, is this. Remembrance is a practice in the present. It's not a reaction in the moment to choose to be faithful or unfaithful to an event. For the Israelites, the whole bent of their life was, in these latter generations, was to practice the worship of the Baals and the Ashtoreths. And because that was their practice, they forgot God's character, God's ability to redeem. And when they forget who God is, then they forget who they are. Because their identity and their calling and what it means to live into the promise, both the covenant promise to receive the inheritance of the land, but also I would say even as important as that, the call to be a blessing to the nations, which that is also part of the Abrahamic promise. It's not only the promise of descendants and land, but it's the promise that Israel would be a blessing to all nations. They are enslaving the peoples around them. I don't think that's a blessing to the nations. But when you forget who God is, you forget who you are.
You know, when we forget, when we retract, when we stop spending time in God's Word and think we got it together, or think we got it going on, and I'm doing good, and God, you put God on the back burner. We stop spending time with Him. And when we stop spending time with Him, the same thing that the Israelites got, it's the same thing, probably another way, but we're going to get the same thing.
Yeah. We reflect what we worship.
Right.
And that's the bottom line for humans, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, I think it's important to note that chapter 2 states that after Joshua died and the elders who walked with him died, that's when they fell away. The new generation hadn't experienced God like Joshua and the elders.
Mm-hmm.
And there seems like there's a cause and effect, because the voice says, consequently, this new generation served the gods of Canaan. you know, after those leaders died.
Yeah, it's so interesting. You know, when Joshua led the people into the promised land at the end of the wilderness wanderings, the new generation, God parted the waters of the Jordan. You remember that?
Right.
And they walked through on dry land. What does that sound like?
Sounds a little Red Sea-ish.
Sounds a little Red Sea-ish. I view that as a liturgical practice of remembrance. What are our liturgical practices of remembrance in worship? What do? Baptism, Lord's Supper. We sing our theology from week to week. We read the scripture. My kids are growing up learning the Lord's Prayer. Why? Because we say the Lord's Prayer every Sunday. We sing the doxology. When we sing the doxology, what are we singing? Praise God, from whom all blessings flow. That gratitude that all gifts are from God. You see, liturgy orients our worship toward something or someone. So liturgy matters. And you're right. So when Joshua's generation died, the new and subsequent generations failed to enact the practices of worship that orient them toward Yahweh. Instead, they gave themselves to the Baals and the Ashtaroths, and we're about out of time. But y'all have been jumping in on all the questions I had at the end already. So this is really good. This is really good. So as we come here toward the end of our time, we see in chapter 2, you might have noticed at the beginning of chapter 1, it said Joshua died.
Right.
And then in chapter 2, it says Joshua died. Right? You're like, wait a minute. What's happening? So we have two different versions. Remember, because we have a whole bunch of oral tradition stories that are passed down, and then they get edited together. Okay, and so this is why we get a repetition of something. It's not that the authors of Judges forgot they already mentioned Joshua died. They're combining two different traditions in the way the stories were passed down. Okay, and we see again that Joshua dies. But here it's with this theological lens over it that reminds us Israel failed to remember. And because of that, Israel adopted Canaanite religious practices. And then it tells us this cycle. This is, Shannon, your point earlier. It tells us in narrative form at the end of chapter 2, this literary and theological cycle, relational cycle, that we're going to see repeated in all the stories throughout Judges. And this is the theological cycle for Israel's experience in history that we will see throughout the Old Testament. Okay? The people sin. Predominantly, it's idol worship, or the assertion that they themselves can be God in God's place, which is idol worship of one kind. Then they experience oppression. God turns them over to the consequences of their sin. Then they repent. God delivers them. There's a season of peace. Then we rinse or don't rinse and repeat. Right? There's a lack of rinsing until baptism in the New Testament. So then we just repeat. And we're going to see that cycle over and over again in Judges. And it's also the cycle we're going to see over and over again in the Old Testament. Right? When the people of Israel wrestle with the reality later in their life of exile at the hands of the Assyrians and the Babylonians, this is what they're going to return to, okay, in their, as they think through it, all right? Okay, so these were the general questions we said we would be thinking about last week. And for tonight, I had a whole bunch of discussion questions, and we've talked about some of them already. So we've talked about what happens when we today fail to remember, right? Luis brought that up. We've talked about a little bit about God's character, right? And what it means to remember who God is. God's the Redeemer and the Rescuer. When we read passages like this, it's easy to assume God's just angry, right? Because it says God burned with anger, right? But what does God ultimately do in this passage? It tells us the whole paradigm. Yes. God does not like sin, but does God leave the people in their experience of oppression?
No.
He comes to their rescue. Why? Because God is the God who led them out of Egypt. That's who God is. He's a redeemer. And so God gives grace. So here's our last question I want us to think about, and then we'll get out of here in 2 minutes. How might this cycle of sin, judgment, repentance, deliverance be a helpful and hopeful word to later generations of Israelites? How might this cycle of sin, judgment, repentance, deliverance, how might that cycle be helpful to later generations of Israelites who might read Judges?
Maybe to remind them of their mistakes.
Okay. So, holds a mirror up to them. So let's not make those same mistakes. And maybe when we do, there's deliverance. Yeah. What else?
Okay.
Hope. And can identify maybe some of our shortcomings today. And even in the midst of that, have hope. Yeah. If we find ourselves in later generations in a season of judgment and oppression because Assyria is coming through, okay, 722, that's when that happens. Maybe we can hold out hope.
If we remember.
Ah. This is good.
I think it's also a reminder that the kind of keeping of the covenant comes out of God's character instead of their because they fail over and over. But it's God's character that brings not the failure but the redemption that comes at the end of that cycle.
Yeah. I think that's really key because this is more about who God is than our own shortcomings. Because Judges is all about our shortcomings, Israel's shortcomings and ours. Though we're going to see these phrases about God's anger and judgment, God keeps coming back over and over and over again to rescue them. And so the big picture of Judges is that God is a God of grace. In the midst of this whole cycle of our sin, God doesn't ever give up on us.
But is it really God coming back or the people coming back because God stayed?
Yeah, that's a good question. And we're out of time. So, but I promise, next week we're going to come back and ask the same questions. Here's my quote to end tonight for us. Judges is about self-assertion and idolatry, the refusal to acknowledge and respond to God's sovereign claim. And we'll come back next week and pick back up with all these questions because we'll get to keep asking them this semester. Blessings, y'all. We are finished. I took you 5 minutes over, so you are dismissed.
What's your